What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Thursday, October 16th. We are just days away from the tip-off of the 2025-26 NBA season. And so I am continuing my series of contender tiers to preview the upcoming season and rank all 30 teams. Today we are doing part four of this series of podcasts, and we will touch on two tiers, tier six and tier five, for a total of four teams, two apiece for each tier. So with that said, let's go ahead and get right into it. So starting off with tier number six, there are two teams in this tier, and this tier is called Who the Hell Knows, because these two teams are probably the two most difficult teams to pinpoint the outcome that they'll have in the upcoming season. On one hand, they have a ton of talent, and on paper, they have the tools to be very, very good teams, solid playoff teams, teams that could be interesting and annoying to play come postseason time. But there are a lot of external variables that could lend them to having a second consecutive disappointing season, because both of these teams were wildly disappointing last year and had hectic seasons. And so due to whether it be injuries, general fit and roster balance, whatever it may be, there's just uncertainty with these teams. And so the question is, who the hell knows where these teams are going to finish? Would it be surprising if they won 50 games? No. Would it be surprising if they won 35 games? Also no. So starting off with the first team in this tier, number 14, we have the Dallas Mavericks, who last season, completely out of left field, traded away their franchise player in Luka Doncic, which pretty majorly derailed their season because Anthony Davis, who was the headliner they got back, immediately gets injured in the first game that he plays for the team, ironically, after some of the reasoning for Luka not playing was because of health and physical conditioning and whatnot. But then while AD is out, Kyrie later in the season tears his ACL and he would be out for the remainder of the season. So in total, Kyrie and Anthony Davis played one game together, one game. So we don't really know what it looks like with them on the court together. AD only played nine total games. They plummeted in the standings without those two guys, losing 9 out of 10 with this makeshift roster before winning a few at the end once AD was back. They eventually end up in the play-in. They beat the Kings in the first game before losing to the Grizzlies. So coming into this year, they will not have Kyrie Irving for the majority of the season. There are people speculating that he could be back by the end of the year. I personally am still a little skeptical of that just because he's been on record saying that he wants to make sure he's only coming back when he's fully, fully 100% healthy. And given that it happened pretty late in the year, even if he did come back, it's probably not till February, March, maybe even April. And at that point, depending on where they are in the standings, it may not be worth it for him to try to come back. So I personally would not be surprised if Kyrie did not play at all this season, but I do think the general speculation is that he will play at some point, but it is very much up in the air when. But because they fell down the standings last year, they got very, very lucky and end up with the number one pick in the draft. So they draft Cooper Flagg, who's a generational prospect, one of the probably five or so best prospects we've had this century, and a guy that a lot of people think can come in and make an instant impact. They add D'Angelo Russell to sort of be the interim replacement for Kyrie Irving in their backcourt. They lose Spencer Dinwiddie in free agency. But other than that, they pretty much have a lot of the same players from last season outside of Flag, AD, D'Lo, and Kyrie. They still have Klay Thompson, Caleb Martin, who they got last year in a trade for Quentin Grimes, which also underratedly was a pretty bad deal for them. Max Christie, who also came over in the Luka trade. They re-signed Dante Exum, still have Najee Marshall. And then at center, they still have Daniel Gafford, who I think will maybe be injured to miss the start of the season, but it's nothing serious. And then Derek Lively going into his third year in Dallas. And so this team has a lot to like and a lot to be skeptical about. And so I have no idea where to put this team. They are actually, in my opinion, probably the hardest team to predict where they could end up. Because let's just look at the positives and why this team could potentially be really good. They, on paper, have the personnel to be a very, very good defensive team, which in the NBA just gives you an incredibly high floor. If you just look particularly at their front court spots, I mean, they're going to have 48 really good minutes defensively at the center position. Lively, I think, is going to start, but Gafford will obviously play a lot of time there. And I'm sure there will be times where AD's playing the five. But regardless of which of those three guys is at the center spot, that is a consistent, solid rim protector and deterrent in the paint that is just going to be there for 48 minutes. So they have one of, if not the best center rotation overall in the NBA. But aside from just the center spot, they still have PJ Washington, who has been a very plus defender since arriving in Dallas, who's got size and length on the perimeter. And then Cooper Flagg, who obviously people are going to love the highlight plays on the offensive end for him as a prospect. But there's an argument to be made that he is a better defensive prospect than he is even an offensive prospect at this point in time. He is a tremendous weak side help defender as a shot blocker. He gets in passing lanes. He's just a playmaker on that end of the court, getting steals and blocks and breaking up passes and being disruptive. He knows how to get to the right spots. He can guard a little bit on the perimeter. He can, as I said, to defend in the paint. Like, he doesn't really have a defensive weakness, and I don't know exactly how good he's going to be right away offensively. I think eventually he'll be very, very good there. But defensively, I have no doubts that he's going to come in and immediately be an impact guy. And so you pair him on the perimeter as a weak side guy that can guard out there next to AD, who's been a perennial defensive player of the year candidate, next to their two centers who, since they've been in Dallas, have given them a tremendous floor as a defensive team anchoring the defense. And there's just no doubt that they're going to be very good on defense, which again, gives you just a tremendous floor as a team. It's very hard to be a top five defensive team in the league and win only 30 games. Like, you're just going to be at the bare minimum a competitive team with a defense like that. None of that is to mention that Max Christie, Dante Exum, Caleb Martin, these are all plus defensive players on the perimeter as well. So they do just have a well-rounded defensive team across this roster. And then Anthony Davis is still really, really good at basketball. He's a top 15 player in the NBA, no doubt about it. Borderline top 10. At his worst, he's still a 25-point per game scorer, 10 rebounds, and one of the best in the paint scorers that we have across the league. Can shoot a little bit in the mid-range. Obviously, he's been in more of a number two role since arriving in LA, but I mean, there's been times where he looked like the best player on the Lakers. And when they did win their championship, he played at a top five player in the league type level. So we know he has that in them, even though he's not as good as Luka Doncic, doesn't do as much offensively as Luka. He's still incredibly impactful as an offensive player. And then I still think there's a chance that Cooper Flagg is just way better than we all think he is, even though we all think he's really good. Like, I think he has the opportunity to come in and be one of the most instant impact rookies that we've had in a really long time. He's probably not going to put up the stats that Wemby did, for example, but Wembanyama in his rookie year looked clunky on offense. He was inefficient. He turned the ball over a ton. His advanced stats on the offensive end were all negative across the board. But I think Cooper Flagg, the ways he contributes are not just going to be scoring. He is a tremendous passer, a connective piece, an elite playmaker for his size and position. He keeps the ball moving. He makes the right reads. When the defense collapses, he basically 10 out of 10 times makes the right decision, whether it be kicking out to a shooter in the wing, throwing out the lob to the big man, or just scoring himself. And he's got a lot of guys around him that are going to thrive with him doing that. He's going to be able to generate offense. And his biggest question mark has really been the shot, and can he hit consistently from outside? But he was tremendous in the second half as a shooter at Duke. He's looked really good in the preseason and comfortable taking those shots, not only just spot ups, but off the dribble, you know, step back, turnaround, fadeaway shots, behind the back, off dribble moves. Like, he just looks ready. And so, like I said, he's not going to put up the stats Wemby did, but I think there's a chance he has more impact because of the things he does on the offensive end besides scoring. So if Cooper Flagg comes in right away and is a fringe all-star, which I personally cannot rule out, I think he's that special. I think he could be that good right away. And I think he will be that good at the bare minimum eventually, a couple of years down the line. Then that's two all-star level two-way players in their front court next to a group of highly impactful defensive role players. They still do have shooters on the wing in Klay Thompson, Max Christie, Cody Martin, Najee Marshall, etc. So they do just have a deep group of personnel that contribute on both ends of the court. And then the cherry on top would be Kyrie. If they can be good enough defensively and hang around offensively with Cooper Flagg running a lot of the show until Kyrie is back, then he could easily come back, you know, 15, 20 games left in the season, get his feet under him to close the year. They play well down the stretch. Suddenly they're a 5 or 6 seed. And then they're very dangerous going into the postseason. So the argument for Dallas is legitimate just because I think their defense will give them a very high floor. Cooper Flagg could be legitimately really, really good right away. And Anthony Davis, if he can stay healthy, is still one of the 15 best players in the NBA. But there's also a lot of things that can go wrong for this team. On the negative side of things, Anthony Davis, I just said, if he can stay healthy, well, that has not been something that he has done consistently in his career. He has hit the 65 game mark one single time in the last 7 years. He only played 51 games last year, then did have a very big outlier, 76 games in 2024, but 56 games a year before that, then 40, then 36, then 62, then 56. So he's averaged 54 games per season, which is an average of 28 games missed per year. And so even if they play at 50 win pace when he plays, if we assume he's going to be on his average, which is 54 games, if they play at 50 win pace, then they would be at 33-21 in those games. And so if you do the math on for them to avoid the play-in, since the play-in has been a thing, you've needed 48 or more wins every year except for one where it was the weird year where everybody was kind of just around 500 for whatever reason. So 48 wins is basically a benchmark for being a top 6 seed in the West. So if they want to hit 48 wins, they've got to go 15-13 in the games that he misses to hit 48 wins. And that's assuming they play at 50 win pace, which doesn't sound that hard. You know, oh, well, just 500 with that AD shouldn't be that bad. But just to give you some context, they went 5-17 last year in games that Luka, Kyrie, and AD did not play. And they're not going to have Kyrie for the majority of the season. 5-17. They were atrocious when Anthony Davis did not play. And I know that Cooper Flagg should help some of that. I don't anticipate them being that bad when AD's out. But to go from 5-17 all the way up to still an above 500 team without Anthony Davis, I just don't see it, which to me says that unless he has some outlier healthy season, which I wouldn't bank on it, then it's going to be more than likely that they're not hitting that 48 win mark, which means more than likely they're going to be in the play-in as sort of a best case scenario for them, just because I just don't know how they're going to survive offensively with no Kyrie and no Anthony Davis, even if they are very good defensively. Because I don't know who is going to handle the ball for this team. Who's going to create on this team? It just feels like they're going to have an unfair amount on Cooper Flagg's plate. Like I said, I think that he can probably handle a lot of those increased responsibilities, but I don't think you're going to get the best version of him if you're asking him to play point guard, which he literally started a point guard in a preseason game this week, which sure, I'm sure he's capable. He can do it. But if you want the best version of Cooper Flagg, it's going to be a sort of a point forward ancillary ball handler role where he's mixing some of that in with some off ball cutting and whatnot, not where he's having to dribble, pound the ball and run the offense. Because if we're being honest, one of his biggest flaws coming into the NBA is his ball handling. He's not a bad ball handler, but he's not a starting NBA point guard level ball handler right now. He does have a great IQ and feel for the game offensively. He's a great passer. But again, it just feels like so much to ask. Like even at Duke in college, he wasn't asked to be a ball dominant on-ball guy. So to have him do that in the pros, I mean, the guy is still 19 years old. He was supposed to be a college player this year. He graduated a year early. He's incredibly young. It just feels like a lot on the plate of him. And I do think his stats will suffer if he's asked to be an on-ball player right out of the gate like that. And so if it's not him, then who on this team can dribble the ball? Who on this team can run an offense? Is it D'Angelo Russell? Because I'm going to go ahead and say no thanks from me on that one. He has proven that the more involved he is, the worse off teams are. So I understand the signing in the sense that he was incredibly cheap. He can make outside shots. He can self-create a little bit. He's a very poor, poor man's Kyrie Irving in some ways. So I get that. You're trying to replicate that for at least half a season. But I just personally do not want to be in the D'Angelo Russell business. And if you are, I want him to be a third or fourth offensive option like he was in LA with the Lakers. Now he is immediately the most important ball handler on the team, the most important offensive creator on the team outside of Anthony Davis. And so to me, like I just don't want him in that role, but he has to play it for this team. He has to. There's nobody else to do it because, like I said, it's a lot to ask of Flag. And then other than Russell, what is it? Jaden Hardy, Dante Exum, playing Najee Marshall at point forward. Like, they just don't have options. They don't have ball handlers on this team. And it's going to make this offense very, very clunky at times. And I know you can say, well, they run the offense through Anthony Davis. And I think that they should do that in spurts. But I think Anthony Davis, as an offensive player, he is gifted and he is talented, but I view him as an elite, elite play finisher, not as somebody who's should be tasked with being a main creator for a roster. Because when he does create, he often settles more for mid-range jumpers, which that's not an efficient shot. He doesn't hit them at a high enough clip for him to justify shooting over 5 mid-range jumpers a game. But when he's asked to self-create, he kind of sometimes falls back on that. And so there's no proof that a number one option Anthony Davis team can be a 50-win team, especially when his main ball handler is D'Angelo Russell and his second best and most important player is a rookie. So offensively, I get really concerned about what this might look like. And I said this before, but what if Kyrie doesn't come back? What if they're forced to play the entire season with D'Angelo Russell as the point guard on this team? So for Dallas, like I said, it's hard to say what they'll be. They'll be damn good defensively. The health of Anthony Davis is an uncertainty. The ball handling and shot creation in the backcourt is an uncertainty. Whether Kyrie is going to play at all this season is an uncertainty. How ready and capable Cooper Flagg is offensively as an on-ball player is an uncertainty. So there are a lot of uncertainties and a few certainties. And they have a good roster and they have talent on the team. But I think for me, it's going to be tough to overcome the lack of quality in their backcourt. And I do think Anthony Davis is probably going to miss 25 to 30 games. I don't know. There's almost no proof that he won't. So I think they're going to be really bad when he doesn't play offensively. And so ultimately, I'm a little lower on Dallas. I view them more as a play-in team, but more in the 9-10 range than the 7-8 range. Maybe Kyrie's back by then and they can win 2 games and get into the play-in, for example. But it's going to be an uphill battle from then, even if they do that, because then they're going to have to play Oklahoma City or Denver or somebody really good in the first round. Then moving to the other team in the who the hell knows tier, we have the Philadelphia 76ers because they have a lot of the same concerns. And honestly, who the hell knows what they're going to look like next year. But last year was a just disaster season for them. They got only 19 games out of Joel Embiid, 41 games out of Paul George, 52 out of Tyrese Maxey. They win only 24 games, a lot of that being because they definitely were tanking at the end of the year because they had a top 7 protected pick that would have been really bad if it fell outside of that top 7 and they were forced to hand that pick over to, of all teams, Oklahoma City. But not only do they remain in range to keep it, but they actually had their pick get elevated into the top 3 in the lottery. So they got very lucky and they end up with VJ Edgecombe at the number 3 overall pick. They also draft Jani Broome in the second round. They add Trendon Wofford, who a lot of people like. They bring back Quentin Grimes on a 1 year qualifying offer deal. So he'll be an unrestricted free agent next year, but he was very, very good for this team down the stretch last season. They should get Jared McCain back at some point. He did re-injure himself and will be out to start the season, but it's not a season ending thing like last year. Don't know exactly when he'll be back, but definitely at some point. And then their biggest loss by far was Gershon Yabusele, who is now with the Knicks. So they still have their core of Paul George, Maxey, and Embiid. Aside from the guys I mentioned, they bring back Kyle Lowry and Eric Gordon in the backcourt. They still have Kelly Oubre on the wing and Andre Drummond backing up Joel Embiid. And on paper, this is one of the most talented teams in the Eastern Conference, with Indiana and Boston essentially out of the picture, with Milwaukee a shell of what they've been from a talent perspective. There is opportunity in this conference to make noise, and Philadelphia, if all went right, is positioned well to strike. And so, just like Dallas, there are a wide variety of outcomes for this team. On the positive side, Joel Embiid, he appears to maybe be healthy. They said he might be ready for opening day, but it's really hard to judge what you say. But I don't even really think they need 65, 70 games out of Embiid to be a pretty good team. Joel Embiid throughout his career has a 65.3% win percentage. The Sixers win basically two-thirds of their games when he plays. That is 54 win pace. And he has had varying supporting cast throughout his career. You know, that includes the season where Ben Simmons didn't even play and it was him and a bunch of role players. So bottom line is, when Joel Embiid plays and he's himself, this team is very, very good and they win in the regular season. So even if he can just play 50 games, 50 is obviously a low number. It's more than he's played over the last 2 years. Didn't even make it to 20 games last year. But if he can just play 50 games, that would put them at 33-17. If they match his typical win percentage, that means just to hit 500, they only have to go 8-24 without him. And that would just get them to 500, which is, this is a different story than Dallas, because in the East, 500 is almost guaranteed to get you in the play-in at the very least. And it might even get you this year in a 7 or 8 seed on the higher end of the play-in. And I wouldn't be totally shocked if the 6th seed in the East is at least hovering around 500. So I say all that to say, if they can just get 50 games out of Joel Embiid and play at the normal winning percentage that they do when he plays, they should waltz to a 500 record with ease, and honestly should win even more than that. So I know that is an if with Embiid, but my point is just that it's a pretty low bar if we're being honest with ourselves. So if they can get that from Embiid, and then if Paul George can have a bounce back season. I know that the discourse surrounding Paul George is that the guy is completely washed. And I won't lie, he did have a pretty rough first year in Philadelphia. But I am very much, I'm going to stand up for Paul George, because I'm on the front that the talk of his downfall is overstated. Because last year was an uphill battle for him. He was injured to start the season, and they were already very bad when he came back. So there was pressure for them to start winning ASAP. He thought he'd be next to Embiid, and he wasn't. He was in a new role, a new city, new system, new everything. Oftentimes these guys perform better in year two. And he played hurt for a lot of the year is what it sounded like. So I don't think he was 100%, but he felt like he had to rush back because the team was in such a hole that they needed to at least try to come out of it ASAP, or else the season was going to be lost, which ultimately is what happened. But also, even last year, I know his scoring was down. I know his efficiency was down. I know the advanced numbers were not very good. But he wasn't some bum out there. He's still a above-average defensive player that can guard multiple positions on the wing. He still is a consistent knockdown shooter from three-point range, both on the catch and shoot and off the dribble. He still is a plus passer and playmaker for his position that you can run a little bit of offense through. Like, this narrative that he is just this negative player now is completely a misconception, in my opinion. Like, at worst, he's like a Swiss Army knife do-it-all role player, like a Derek White, for example. Like, he hits threes from outside like White can. He defends like White can. He can do secondary playmaking like White can. I'm not saying that they're the exact same player, but I just mean in terms of the role they can fill. At worst, he can just be a significantly overqualified superstar role player, which that's not what they paid him for. I mean, he's making max money, so in theory, you'd want him to be the 20 to 25 point per game scorer as well. But if we're just being honest about what he is, like, he still is a good, positive player in the NBA. I'll also point out that he had a similarly bad season to what he actually had back in 2022. He only played 31 games in 2022. He had negative advanced offensive stats across the board, similar to what he had last year. And he was injured and banged up most of the season, just like last year. But the year after that, he bounced back and had an awesome year. So I don't know why there's just no possibility in people's minds that he can't bounce back and still be a good player. I personally firmly expect him to be much better than last year. And I still think he has a lot of juice left in the tank, because just 2 years ago, he put up his most efficient season as a professional athlete. So to think that he would just precipitously fall off a cliff like that, I just think there was external factors, and I think this year, I personally expect more out of him. So if he even bounces back just a little bit, on top of Embiid playing roughly half a season, we've got Maxey still on this team, who's only 24 years old and continues to just be a damn good scorer and a mismatch on the perimeter against opposing defenders, then there's a lot of guys on this roster outside of their core three that are still really talented that would be the icing on the cake if they can get their core guys to play, like Vijay Edgecombe. I don't know what he's going to be as a rookie, but we don't know for sure that he won't just be awesome right out the gate. He should immediately be an impactful defender. The shot is inconsistent, but what if he can hit it at an average rate? What if he can do a little bit of shot creation on the offensive end? What if he can be an awesome cutter and backcourt mate next to Maxey right away? Like, we can't rule that out. The guy was the number three overall pick and one of the top prospects of this class for many, many years now. He has the talent. He looked good in summer league. He's looked good in preseason. We know he's a freak athlete at the very least. Like, if they can get even just positive impact play from him as a rookie, that's a huge plus for this team. Then we've got Jared McCain, who was awesome last year before he got hurt. Averaged 15 points per game on the season, but towards the end, right before he went down with the injury, he was scoring 20 plus regularly. And so that's another guy that I think can be a big time scorer for this team, assuming he comes back not too late in the season. Then you've got Quentin Grimes, who averaged 22 points a game, 5 rebounds, 5 assists on 47% from the field and 37% from three last year with the Sixers. So they've got other scoring options on this team and talent beyond Embiid, talent beyond Paul George, next to Maxey, and a young core that actually does have a lot of upside aside from their main guys. So they can get 50 games out of Embiid. If Paul George can bounce back a little bit, if any of these guys can step up and be legitimate, good rotation players, then there's no reason Philadelphia can't win 45 plus games and be a top 6 seed in the East. However, there's obviously tremendous downside with this team. We saw what it looked like last year. This is a lot of the same roster from last year outside of Edgecombe, and they lost Yabusele, et cetera. Like, if they were that bad last year, there's no reason they couldn't theoretically be that bad again this year. They'd have to get unlucky, because I do think they were unlucky last year. Embiid played only 19 games, and when he did play, he looked like a severely compromised version of himself, only 24 points a game, which was 10 less than what he had scored the previous season. His shooting was the worst it's ever been, 44% from the field, under 30% from three, and he only played 39 games the year before that. He played 66 and 68 in 23 and 22 respectively, but then 51 in 2021, 51 in 2020. And so it's not a sure thing that he can even get to 40 games. It's been 3 seasons ago since he even got to the 40 game mark. And so I'm saying, can he just play 50 games? It's not a guarantee he could even play 50 games. Like, we really just have not seen it out of him in recent seasons. Also, I'm higher on Paul George, but I could be wrong. He could just be washed now. He did look a little slower across the board last year. He had his worst 3-point percentage since his rookie season, the lowest scoring output since he won Most Improved Player 12 years ago. And he didn't necessarily have the same burst. Then Tyrese Maxey put together the least efficient season of his career. In the increased role, you know, he had a career low field goal percentage, career low true shooting percentage, lowest 3-point shooting he's had since his rookie year. And he didn't look as comfortable having to do everything offensively. He obviously is going to look better when Embiid's playing, when Paul George is 100%. And he didn't have the luxury of that next to him. So his numbers did take a little bit of a hit. And then there's a chance Vijay Edgecombe isn't ready. There's a chance that McCain takes a while to come back and has to ramp up when he's back. Kelly Oubre is very important to this team as one of the only reliable wing players next to Paul George. And what if he shoots sub 30% again? Like, there is a lot of things to not like about this team, just as there is things to like about. And so that is why they're in the tier called Who the Hell Knows, because genuinely, who the hell knows with this team? I do not know how to pinpoint them. They legitimately could win 50 plus games, as I mentioned. They legitimately could win 30 games. They won 24 last year. It can't be ruled out. And so there are just so many unknowns, but I do think with the East being as poor as it is, if they can just get 40 to 50 games out of Embiid, then I do think that should be enough. I think they have enough talent outside of Embiid, and they're good enough when he does play in the Eastern Conference to be in the 40 to 45 win range. And I really do think that that's going to be enough to get in the six seed conversation, because I think the East is not going to be very good this year. So I'm very cautiously optimistic about the Sixers this year, just because with how bad the East is, I just can't see them being a 25-30 win team again. And if Embiid can't play 50 games this year, then I think it's just fair to wonder if he ever will. And then who knows where this franchise is going. But I will say they've almost got this sort of two timeline thing, like the Warriors tried with Edgecombe and Maxey and McCain and Grimes as these young up and coming players. The only problem is a lot of them play the same position. So we'll see how they sort that out. But like I said, I actually think the Sixers have a real shot to be a 6 or 7 seed in the East, and in their best case could even be better than that. But it's hard to have any confidence that they could be better than that just with the health track record and all the other unknowns across the roster. Then moving to the next tier, tier 5, we have the East's middle class, and it is two teams that it will probably be an uphill battle for them to think that they can legitimately contend and make the finals or anything like that. Maybe they get lucky in a matchup and make the conference finals, but I really don't see anything beyond that. Even winning a playoff series isn't necessarily a certainty for them. But I would be very, very surprised if these teams are not in the playoffs. I think that they are very much in the running for a top 4 seed in the East, just given the landscape of it. And so the first team in this tier at number 12 is the Milwaukee Bucks, who last year got off to a very slow start, but they did play very well down the stretch, ended up with 48 wins in the 5 seed. But they go down 0-2 to the Pacers in the first round. Dame eventually tears his Achilles in the postseason, which leads to some tough decisions for this team in the offseason, where they end up waiving and stretching Dame's contract. So Lillard is no longer on this roster, but that does open up space for them to sign Miles Turner away from the Pacers as a replacement for Brook Lopez, who they lose in free agency. They also trade away Pat Connaughton, and then some other minor adds they made were Cole Anthony, Gary Harris, Amir Coffey, and of course, Thanasis Antetokounmpo. Obviously, there's a lot of rumors swirling around this team with Giannis and some of the weird comments that have come out during training camp and the preseason here about, I want to be in Milwaukee, but things can obviously change. So for the first part of this, I'm at least just going to talk about their outlook for this season and not assume sort of any trade or anything like that. But obviously, we can't rule that out at some point down the road this season. But there's really not a lot to like about this team outside of Giannis, if I'm being honest with you. Turner is a fine addition. I thought the number they signed him for was relatively within market value, but he, to me, is more of a complimentary piece. I liked him in his role in Indiana, where he's not a focal point of the offense, but more of a weapon they can unleash in the pick and pop in certain matchups to draw bigs out of the paint. As a guy that isn't necessarily relied on to be the core defensive anchor, but a guy that can block shots, but had good reinforcements on the perimeter around him with Nesmith and Nembhard and other guys like Siakam. But in Milwaukee, his role is going to be a little too important for my liking. He's going to be probably the number two option on the team, which I think he's underqualified to do. I think he's lacks self-creation and is heavily reliant on other players to get him the ball in his spots. And sure, Giannis can do a little bit of that, but there's not a lot of other guys that can do that for him. And so I don't know what it's going to look like. I know that the proof of concept of him as a player is similar to Brook Lopez. So I know he can be a contributor on this team offensively, but They don't have Dane. They don't have Drew Holiday. They don't have Chris Middleton. They don't have these guys that were opening up the space for Brooke Lopez and what will now be Miles Turner. So, I don't know exactly what it's going to look like. Not a bad addition, but to ask him to be the number two option is a little bit much. Then probably if he's not the number two option, then it has to be Kyle Kuzma, who I still do not understand why they made that trade last year. I wouldn't have traded Chris Middleton straight up for Kyle Kuzma, let alone give it a unprotected swap down the road. Did not understand that move at the time. And Kuzma was just unplayable in the playoffs last year. Under 6 points a game, not even one assist a game, 34% from the field, 20% from three, 50% from the free throw line. He is a shot chucker. He does not play with the sort of IQ and feel for the game that is necessary to be a contributor on a winning team. And he is as inefficient as they come. He takes bad shots. He doesn't make them. He's rarely in the right spots on either end of the court. And so I don't think he's a winning player. He didn't prove it last year, even finally getting out of Washington on a team that had aspirations to win. So I just don't see it with Kyle Kuzma. Kevin Porter Jr., he actually was pretty good for this team last year. He shot the ball probably the best of his career in a more limited role behind Dame. But obviously when Dame was out, he had more of an expanded role. But he did play pretty well, so I'll give him credit there. But I still don't really trust him as a full-time starting point guard. I think he's a little bit sporadic. The shot's a little inconsistent. He's still a little ball stoppery at times. Then I've always had a soft spot for Gary Trent. He went nuclear in the playoffs with two 30-point games and single-handedly won them that one game and should have won them the second game. But obviously Trent is nothing special and at best should be a fit starter. And that's kind of the problem with this roster. They have basically a bunch of guys who should be maybe seventh or eighth men at best. And the problem is they're going to need some of these guys to be important, important role players between Bobby Portis, AJ Green, Taurean Prince, Gary Harris, Cole Anthony, Amir Coffey, Andre Jackson. None of those guys are terrible players. I think they all in the right situation can contribute, but none of them have an elite, elite skill, except for maybe AJ Green as a shooter. And all of them are sort of one-way players. You're either conceding defense by having them out there or conceding offense and shooting. And then in some cases like Prince and Harris, they're kind of just like okay on both ends, but not very good at either. So it's a lot of just meh players where if you had these guys as your ninth or 10th men, sure, all power to you, not a problem. But they're going to need a couple of these guys to start. They're going to need a couple of them to be the most important guys off the bench for the team. And so I just don't see the talent and support around Giannis that they're going to need. I think they're praying for a leap from Ryan Rollins. And I think he's probably the biggest upside piece they have in terms of a guy that can defend on the perimeter and shoot from deep a little bit more consistently. But I have big questions. One, how the hell are they going to generate offense aside from Giannis? Like I said, their backcourt might be the worst backcourt in the NBA between Porter Jr. and Ryan Rollins and Trent and Green, who are good shooters but don't really do anything else on offense. They have no reliable creation there. They have no reliable ball handlers or proven commodities that can help run an adult level NBA offense. And so it's going to be Giannis having to do almost everything. He's going to have to be the point guard a lot of the times. He's going to have to bring the ball up. He's going to have to initiate. And I know Giannis can do some of that stuff, but when we've seen Giannis at his worst in the playoffs, it's when teams are able to kind of stack the paint and force him to force things, basically. And I just worry that there's going to be a lot of that this season where he's having to force things because nobody else can create anything on the roster. The other question is on the defensive end, who's going to guard the perimeter? Like I said, Turner's a good shot blocker. Giannis is still a tremendous defender, so they've got a decent foundation on their back line. But outside of those two, their perimeter defense is really, really underwhelming. I don't know who the point of attack defender is. You can't go into a season thinking Gary Harris and Kyle Kuzma and Taurean Prince and Gary Trent are supposed to be defensive stoppers for you guys. Like, those guys are just not at the level they need defensively. They do not have a go-to point of attack defender. They do not have a guy that I trust at all to stop the league's best ball handlers and perimeter scorers. So that's a huge question. Do you try to use Giannis as more of that role? But God, that's a lot to ask out of the guy. He's like the best and most versatile defender on the team. He's also by far the best offensive initiator and creator. Like, he can't do everything for this team. And so they're going to need people to step up, but I genuinely don't know who's going to be the one to step up. And then, of course, the question of what happens when Giannis misses 15 to 20 games. It's going to be ugly because their defense is going to plummet and their offense is going to plummet. I don't know who's going to score for this team when he's out. How are they making up those 30 points? I don't know who's going to be the backline defender aside from Miles Turner, who again can be an effective shot blocker in the paint, but is not very versatile. Once they pull him out on the perimeter, there's no help there. It shall be a wide open lane and a lot of guys that are easy to fly by with the ball. So Giannis has been relatively durable. So if he can play 65, 70 games, then they should be able to stay afloat in the games he doesn't play, because even if they lost most of them, they should have enough of a cushion. But if he were to miss 20 games, 25 games, have any sort of injury, this team could absolutely tank to the bottom of the standings, even in a weak Eastern Conference, because they are so talent deficient, this team. It is a lot of specialists or one-way players or just generally limited personnel. And I just don't see the support on the roster, even with the Miles Turner ad or anything like that. So they're going to need a superhuman performance out of Giannis for this team to have any chance to make noise. And I know I've been all negative on the roster, but I think so highly of Giannis. I think that he will give this team a floor. Like, I think if he plays 70 games, like, they're going to win 45 games. That's just, they just are. He in the Giannis era, they've been a consistent 45 to 50 wins every single year, regardless of who's been around Giannis, regardless of the defense is having a good year, who the coach is, who the supporting cast, when he's been more injured, more healthy, like, they still just win that amount of games. So again, they're in the East middle class. So I would be shocked if they like miss the playoffs altogether, barring some Giannis like significant injury, but it is going to be the Giannis show. and he's going to have to do everything on both ends of the court, create, score, defend, play, make, initiate, all of it. And I think he's capable of doing that for, you know, most of the season, but I don't know how they win anything come playoff time. And he's probably going to run out of gas at some point. And over a 7-game series, they'll become really predictable on both ends of the court, and it'll just be easy to find advantages as an opponent. So the Bucks, again, not a very good team overall from a personnel standpoint and talent, but Giannis is that good, and he is such a generational talent and floor raiser that I think that they will win their 45 games, make the playoffs as a 4, 5, or 6 seed, and probably lose first round, which honestly, that's what they've done over the last few years anyway. So even though the floor for this team is so much lower than some of the other teams he's been on, their ceiling is probably in line with what they've actually accomplished. And so it is fair to wonder, will this be Giannis's last year in Milwaukee? And I think it's on the table. I think if they do what I think they'll do, which again is be a middling playoff team that loses first round, I don't know how he doesn't look around and say, I do not see the path here. And I do think he really does not want to ask out. I don't think he wants to, but he's laying all the breadcrumbs to say that he will if he absolutely has to. And so I do predict that he will be on another team in probably in 26, 27. I think the offseason makes the most sense as a time for him to sort of enter the trade block in that sweepstakes and the trade request, just because the midseason trades are really difficult. There's just half the teams that would be interested won't be able to make it work with the cap, with the apron and all of that. And so I think the team and him will be smart and just play the season out, see how it goes, see where they're at. Hey, and maybe they make a last second heave to add somebody in the offseason, similar to what Dame did when he asked out. He kind of waited till the end of the offseason to see what they were going to do. They brought back Jeremy Grant, but couldn't really do much else, and it wasn't enough for him. So I think it could be similar to that, and we'll see. But for now, I do think he will finish this year in Milwaukee, just because logistically it makes the most sense. And again, I mean, I still think they're going to make the playoffs and be a competitive team, but it's really just going to be for him and no other reason. Then moving to number 11, the second team in the East's middle class, I have the Atlanta Hawks, who last year, as they typically do, hovered around 500 for most of the season. They were 18-15 when Jalen Johnson suffers a minor injury that eventually would turn into a major injury. He came back briefly, but was eventually ruled out for the season. And they finished the year 22-27 after that point. So very clearly a different team without him. They ended up at the eighth seed at the end of the year, but they lost back-to-back play-in games to actually miss the playoffs despite being in position to make it at the end of the regular season. But they had a very busy and, in my opinion, very productive and positive offseason. They make a bit of a splash by adding Kristaps Porzingis in a deal where they really did not have to give up very much. And then in free agency, they make two impact additions as well with Luke Kennard and Nickeil Alexander-Walker. They also make minor moves, adding Charles Bassey, Caleb Pusin, a couple other guys. I actually like Caleb Pusin, just hit a game winner in preseason earlier this week. And then they draft Asa Newell in a deal where they traded back from the late lottery to the mid-20s. In that deal, they pick up a unprotected first-round pick from New Orleans, which it's been well documented how just irresponsible I think that deal was for New Orleans. And credit to the Hawks for taking advantage of a team that doesn't really seem like they know what they're doing. But aside from that, they lose Caris LeVert, Georges Niang, Terrence Mann, Clint Capella, Kobe Bufkin, and Larry Nance. A lot of solid players, but I think the additions they made certainly outweigh those losses that they had. And so going into this season, a lot of people are high on the Hawks, but me included. I think the East is wide open, and I think there is a ton to like about this group. Obviously, the headliner for this team is and will continue to be Trae Young. And I actually thought last year he showed flashes of maturing as a player. I thought he was a little bit more willing to play off ball. I thought he had slightly better shot selection. He posted a career high in assists because he was willing to be more of a distributor, which I know is funny to say for a guy that almost perennially averages 10 assists a game, but just a little less ball dominant at times. He actually did show a little bit of an increased effort on defense. He is never going to be some great defender just because of his physical limitations and size, but he at least showed progress as someone that was trying more, which we hadn't seen a lot of, out of him in the past couple seasons. I've always been a Trae guy. I do firmly believe that he's good enough to be the focal point of an offense, maybe not to win a championship, but in the same way that a modern day James Harden can be. We saw last year with the Clippers when Kawhi was out, Harden did everything for the team. He was the focal point, and they were a really successful team, at least in the regular season. And so I think Trae Young's good enough to replicate that, similarly to what Cade Cunningham did last year for the Pistons too. Not a lot of talent on that roster. He had to do basically everything, but they were a 44-win team and a top six seed in the East. And I don't really understand some of the misalignment on reputations across a guy like Trae versus a Cade Cunningham, if you just look at the two. You might not believe this based on their reputation, but Trae Young actually, in some ways, was a more efficient player than Cade last year, despite his reputation. He had a higher true shooting percentage than Cade Cunningham. He had a higher offensive rating than Cade, more offensive win shares than Cade. So as an offensive player alone, Cade's obviously better defensively, but a lot of that is just due to his size and natural ability there. Offensively alone, Trae was arguably better last year than Cade, despite Cade being an all-NBA player and Trae not even really getting a thought for that. And so I know he's going to continue to get shit from people for his defense, for taking bad shots, for his low field goal percentage. But I think he is just such a unique talent as a distributor and an offensive manipulator and a lob thrower and a pick and roll ball handler, like all these things that are such commodities in the NBA that he just can do in his sleep. And it's just second nature to him, not to mention the scoring and his ability to get to the free throw line and his floater game and his range from outside. Like I think he really is a special talent, but I do think you have to surround him with the correct fits and personnel to make it work. But I do think that they've done a really good job of this offseason tailoring the team to what they need next to him. And so just going down the line, Jalen Johnson, he was spectacular last year, you know, just under 20 points, 10 rebounds, 5 assists. Like, he is on the verge of stardom, in my opinion. I wouldn't be surprised if he was a first-time All-Star this year. Wouldn't shock me if he vaulted all the way up to All-NBA. I think he's a elite player in transition. He is a very good player at his position and size as a playmaker and passer. You can run a little offense through him. He's one of those Swiss Army knife do-it-all forwards that the NBA so highly commoditizes. And he's still so young. He's 23 years old. So if he can blossom into a first option of sorts for this team and stay healthy, then Trey can be more of the facilitator. And that's a really, really good 1-2 punch and one of the better offensive duos that the Eastern Conference has. Additionally, last year, when they traded DeJounte Murray for Dyson Daniels, I was on record saying I thought it was going to be a net positive addition by subtraction with Murray and that Dyson Daniels could be one of the breakout players in the league. Well, he was. He won the Most Improved Player Award. He was spectacular defensively, 3 steals a game. He shot a little bit better from 3 than he had in his career at 34%, but still obviously is not overly consistent there. But he was just a great backcourt pairing with Trey on the defensive end of the court. He's got size at 6'8", despite having the ball skills and ability as a guard. And he also is somehow only 22 years old. So, I mean, anything they get beyond what he showed last year offensively is going to be a plus. I do think there's more room for him to grow as sort of a initiator offensively. I think the skill set's there. He just needs to get more comfortable reading the defense, and then they can run the offense through him a little bit more. But he's got a good feel for the game. He needs to improve the shot. But again, still a really nice player and a good fit next to Trae Young. Zach Risoche. He started off slow last year, and I was on record not being very high on him as a player coming into the draft. But I'm willing to concede. I mean, I thought last year in the second half, he showed real strides. So from late January on, he shot 42% from 3 and averaged 15 a game. So he was way better in the second half. If he can continue to be an above average 3-point shooter, to grow into the defensive potential that he has with his physical attributes and dabble a little bit more as a shot creator, then I have no doubt that he's going to have a really good career. It's just in what capacity. Is he going to just be a 3-and-D guy? Can he be more of a offensive threat with the ball in his hands? But I don't really think this team necessarily needs him to do that. I think if he is a rock solid 3-and-D player on the perimeter, then that's going to be more than enough to contribute and impact this team in a big way. Obviously, Porzingis was their big addition. I think he's a tremendous add. Health is an issue with him, but I still think he's one of the most unique talents in the NBA as a mismatch, and his archetype of player is just very rare. A guy that can hit 40% of his threes from up to 25 plus feet away from the basket, but also has a good post game, but also is a versatile defender that protects the rim and blocks shots and can attack closeouts on offense. Like, he's just a really, really skilled big, and he's massive, and he's impactful on both ends of the court. We saw how good Boston looked with him at the 5, and it allowed them to play 5 out on offense while also still having a versatile defense with rim protection. And so the vision there is for him to do the same thing here. I think he'll be a great pick and pop partner for Trey. I think he also is underratedly a good roller as well, can be a good pick and roll partner, and he's got the athleticism to dunk over guys as a lob threat, which Trey, as we know, one of the best lob throwers in the NBA. So I loved the Porzingis ad, because again, it cost them nothing. They basically got him for salary dumps and some second round picks. So that's a no-brainer deal you make 10 out of 10 times. And then just looking at their bench, a lot of guys that I like too. I think Nikhil Alexander-Walker is the exact kind of skill set that you want to pair Trey Young with. He's not a on-ball dominant guy, but he can handle the ball a little bit in spurts. But he is a very, very good perimeter defender and can cover up a lot of what Trey lacks on that end of the court. He's got size. He's got length. His shot has continued to improve throughout his career. He's at least league average at this point. So I love that ad. I thought it was exactly what they needed. It between him and Dyson Daniels, one of them playing next to Trey at all times, that's going to be a really nice defensive foundation next to him, so that you at least have reinforcements if he does get put into sticky situations on the defensive end. Luke Kennard, underrated playmaker, really good 3-point shooter. I've always liked him as a player. He's solid ad. Okongwu, poor guy, finally got in the starter last year. Then they bring Porzingis in. He's good enough to be a starting center in the NBA at this point. He's a very good rebounder for his size, a good finisher, stretched out his range a little bit to the 3-point line last season. Still not super consistent, but at least he's showing progress there, and then he's a solid, versatile defender as well. So one of the best, if not the best, backup big in the NBA at this point if he doesn't start. And then I know people really like Mo Gay, his defensive versatility at 6'11", Veet Krejci also has shown the ability to shoot 42% with the Hawks over the last 2 years at 6'8". And then Asenuel, you know, whatever he provides, cherry on top for this team. But I think the thing I like most about this Hawks team is their lineup versatility. They can go two bigs. Porzingis is a good enough of a shooter where they can play him and Okongwu together. So go sort of a jumbo size lineup where then you've got Johnson at the three, Arisa Shea at the three, whatever. Dyson Daniels is 6'8 at the two guard spot. So they can be massive next to Trae Young. I mean, their starting lineup is going to be four guys, 6'8 or taller next to Trae as is, but that's even before they play two bigs out there together. They also can go small ball. I think Jalen Johnson is capable of playing the five in spurts, and you move Arisa Shea down to the four, put Dyson out there with Nickeil Alexander-Walker. That's still a really good defensive team with a ton of versatility and shooting and offense around Trae. So they have much more versatility and lineup flexibility now. And I think that is such a key thing in today's NBA. You can't be a one-trick pony. You have to be able to adapt. You have to be able to have counters. You have to be able to have different tools of how you can manipulate your roster to take advantage of matchups. And I think that they have that around Trae Young, even though he is one of the bigger liabilities on defense. They have the infrastructure around him to make up for it. But obviously, the Hawks have been hard to trust over the years. I picked them to make the playoffs last year, and they flamed out in the play-in. They have been a team that on paper had maybe the talent to compete and make the playoffs over the past few years, but they have been a just consistent mainstay as a mediocre lottery team. And when they do get in the playoffs, it's via the play-in every single time. So I understand some level of hesitancy with them. And a lot of those questions are still going to remain of can Trae be hidden enough on defense for it not to be an issue for them? They've never had a top 10 defense in the Trae Young era. And I think they at least have most of the personnel to be able to do it, but the proof's in the pudding, and they haven't been able to surround him with enough defense to get them to that point, which means they have to have a really good offense if they want to be good. But the offense has been semi-mediocre over the past few years too. Then Jalen Johnson, for as good as he's been, durability has been a major issue for him. 92 games combined over the last two seasons, 36 last year, 56 the year before. He's still super young, but he needs to prove he can put together like a 65-70 game season. And if he does, then I think the floor and ceiling for this team get raised exponentially. But look, if he's playing 45-50 games, then that's a big hole that they're leaving on offense that someone's going to have to fill. He's such an important X factor for them. And I think that their ceiling is almost directly tied to his ceiling this season. And if he's not playing, then the dynamic of this team changes completely. That doesn't even mention Porzingis, who has been one of the least durable players in the NBA in his career. Since his third season, 48 games back in 2018, missed the entire 2019 season, 57 in 2020, 43 in 2021, 51 in 2022, 65 in 23, 57 in 24, and only 42 last year. And then when he came back for the playoffs, he was a total shell of himself. And then 2024, he missed the majority of the postseason as well. So he has just not been able to stay on the court. Over the last 8 years, that's 45 games per year. If you exclude the year he missed the whole season, it's still only 52 games per season. He's only had 60 plus games once in 8 years. So as much as I love the addition on paper, he's got to stay healthy for it to matter at all. I do think that they have a good enough rotation where if he misses 30 games, they're still going to be plenty good. Like I said, Okongwu is an overqualified backup and good enough to be a starting center in the NBA. But of course, that moves everyone up in the pecking order. Then you need more out of Newell, who's a rookie. So who knows what he's going to look like as a backup big. Mo Gay has got size and length, but is more of a wing than he is a traditional big. So there are question marks on what the team will look like when Porzingis doesn't play, which is almost a guarantee that he's going to miss some time at some point during the season. So between those two, if they both miss a lot of time, then it's going to be a lot of the same of Trae Young and, you know, a lot of so-so talent next to him offensively and probably at best a league average defense. So that has not been good enough to be anything more than a 500 team in the play-in, and I'm not sure it would be again otherwise. And then for as great of a creator as Trae is, there's still question marks about the rest of the team. Johnson is more of a secondary creator. If he can't take a leap into more of that primary role as well, then it's going to be a lot of Trae on offense. And I think that they've been trying to diversify their offensive game But can guys like Dyson Daniels and Zachary Chassé do more on the offensive end? And can those guys hit shots consistently too? Dyson Daniels, 34% last year, but has not been a good three-point shooter throughout his career. Reese Chassé was inconsistent last year. Is he more like the guy that shot 42% in the second half or the guy that shot sub 35% in the first half? That question is still very much up for debate as well, as we've seen him be inconsistent even before he was in the NBA from there. So they have some question marks, but overall, I love what the Hawks did this year. I think that they should, at least, I know we've thought they should do things in the past and then they disappoint a little bit, but they should be a top 4 or 5 team in the East, like without a doubt. They have the talent to do it. I believe in Trae Young. I believe in the additions they made this offseason. I think Jalen Johnson can sprout into a star in this league. And so we'll see. I don't know what their ceiling is. I don't think they're good enough to really contend in the East. Could they maybe upset somebody second round and sneak into the conference finals? I mean, we've seen them do it before in 2021. So I can't say they definitely can't do that, but I wouldn't bet on it. To me, they scream 4 or 5 seed, and then maybe they win first round and then get bounced by a better team in the second round. So we'll see. That would be good progress for them, you know, just to even get back to the playoffs and not in the play-in would be a good year for them. And they've got a lot of assets down the line to be able to add to this team. The only real uncertainty is the extension with Trae Young hanging over their head. But I'm optimistic on the Hawks, and I think they're a solid East middle-class team. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I will have the remaining 2 episodes of this Contender Tiers series released before opening night next week. We still have 4 tiers remaining, so there will be 2 tiers covered in each of the next 2 episodes. Of course, we are getting firmly into the teams that actually maybe could legitimately contend this season. But obviously, I'll give full previews to the remaining 10 teams, and I'll let you know what I think about where they stand going into this year. So with that said, thank you so much for listening, and I will chat with you soon.